It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, most people are only willing to commute about 30 minutes to get to work, according to some urban designers. We'll find out how that's shaped cities throughout history and what it tells us about what your commute could look like in the future. First, from Capitol Hill to our living rooms, there's plenty of disagreement about our politics. It's easy to think that when people make up their minds, there's no room to budge. But it turns out when you get people together in the right setting to talk about the big issues, people are more willing to change their minds than we might think. Our next guest has been doing that for years, a process he calls deliberative democracy. Last month, at an event called America in One Room, hundreds of people gathered in Dallas for a weekend of discussions about immigration, the economy, and more. Surveys taken before and after that event showed a potential for compromise and a growing faith in American democracy. James Fishkin is the Janet M. Peck Chair of International Communication and Professor of Political Science at Stanford University and the Director of the Center for Deliberative Democracy. He's the author of the book Democracy When the People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, set the stage for us. America in One Room, 500 plus people gathering. Paint us a picture of what happened.
Well, the first thing to note is that this was a stratified random sample of the American public, meticulously recruited by the University of Chicago, NORC at the University of Chicago, which is probably the best academic survey research organization. So they went back and back to the people drawn in the sample until they could talk them into coming. So we had this microcosm of America all gathered together. And by the way, it was a controlled experiment. We had a separate group of 840 people who were control group, who didn't come to this big hotel in Dallas near DFW. They just stayed home. They took the survey at the time of recruitment several weeks before and then at the end of the weekend. And so we could see how the public was changing compared to how the people who deliberated change. The public didn't change hardly at all, but the people who deliberated changed dramatically. They were randomly assigned to small groups. So the groups were diverse, maybe 40 small groups, 12, 13, 14 in a group, trained moderators who didn't give anything of their own opinion, but were trained to facilitate a civil discussion. And then we had briefing materials on the key issues facing the country as identified in earlier polling. Those were immigration, health care, the environment, taxes in the economy, and foreign policy. And we had lots of proposals under each topic, maybe a dozen or so under each, and we had detailed briefing books, arguments for and against each proposal. We had a video version of the briefing. We had an executive summary version. And they discussed in depth in the small groups these issues. And then they decided as a group what were the most important questions that they needed to get answered from panels of competing experts, left, right, and center, who would answer the questions from their point of view. And then the people kept on deliberating throughout the whole weekend, and they worked from Thursday night until midday Sunday, and then they flew home. And they discovered that they could not only talk to each other, but listen to each other. And as they listened to each other, people really broke out of their filter bubbles. You know, most of the time when people discuss or think about politics or public policy, nowadays they're getting the information on their social media news feeds. They're tuning in to their favorite sources, whether it's cable television or talk radio or publications on the web, but they tend to seek out information that already confirms their viewpoint. And they may never hear the other side. They discuss with the like-minded. So in a way, this was an experiment about what would people think if they really talked under civil ground rules, if they really talked and listened to people very different from themselves.
And Jim, we'll look at some of your survey results for what you found with this, but I want to talk about what happens often when people talk at the dinner table, when things get contentious or chat, online chats or whatever. It seems like in an uncontrolled environment, the tendency is to not come together, but to push ourselves further apart. Can you talk about that?
Yes. In ordinary life, well, I think, first of all, we have an impression that we're even more divided than we are, and our results certainly show that we're divided, that we're even more divided because the people who tend to speak up are the people who feel the strongest. E.J. Dionne years ago wrote a book, Why Americans Hate Politics, and it was because, in part, when they do talk about politics, it becomes very unpleasant. Because it's a lot easier to talk about the weather than to dredge up a lot of issues that people disagree strongly about. But under moderated conditions, where people understood the idea was to communicate in a civil manner, turns out they have a lot to say to each other that's thoughtful and that gets beyond the kind of triggering points that you get from the cable news and the sort of partisan cues. We didn't give them the partisan cues. We didn't say this proposal was from Democrats or from candidate X, or this proposal was from Republicans or candidate Y. We said, you know, what do you think of this proposal? And here's some arguments for and against. And then they talked about the merits. They actually listened to each other. And they showed something with the most important thing. The opinion changes are very dramatic. But the most important thing, in my view, is they changed for identifiable reasons. And in doing so, they became more informed and they showed that the public is smart. I've got lots of colleagues who have made great careers about how stupid the public is. But in fact, the public is not stupid at all. The public only seems stupid because people tune out and they know everybody's trying to manipulate them and they don't think their voice matters. But if you participate in a situation where you think your voice does matter and the information is there and the ground rules are there, people are collectively pretty smart. In fact, they're wise even.
Talking to James Fishkin from Stanford University about America in One Room, bringing together hundreds of Americans from across the political spectrum to learn and talk about political issues and what happens when people do this, when we talk about politics in a civil setting. James, what kind of things did you see when it came to how people changed their minds pre and post America in One Room?
Well, one of the things that was interesting, as I said, we had all these different issues. We had immigration. We had taxes. We had health care. Issues that are really current in the public discussion. So the thing that was very surprising, and because we had this pre-post control group, so we can compare the changes in the public with the changes in the, we had a lot of statistical precision in evaluating the changes. So if you look just, for example, at the, start with the Republicans, the support for these proposals on the that were more on the right, those support for those lessened, and support among the Republicans and support on for the most progressive proposals on the left lessened among Democrats. It wasn't as much the independents who moved as the partisans of the two major parties. So, for example, listen to this: support for forcing undocumented immigrants to return to their home countries before applying to live and work in the U.S. before deliberation, at the same in the control group, it was 79% of Republicans supported that. But after deliberation, only 40% supported that of Republicans. That's a 39-point drop among Republicans. And support for reducing the number of refugees allowed to settle in the U.S. among Republicans was 66% before deliberation and 34% afterwards. And support for more visas for low-skilled workers Among Republicans, only 31% before deliberation wanted any more of that, but 66% after. And there were reasons. You know, people could understand the need for more low-skilled workers in agriculture and the hospitality industry, and the having the undocumented immigrants return home. When they question the experts, they realize the idea of getting in line and waiting your turn was a little bit of a fantasy when it could, depending on the country you're applying from, it could take decades to get processed. There's certainly many years. It varies by country. But there wasn't an effective line. There needed to be some other solution for the 11 million undocumented immigrants. So these are big changes of opinion. And part of it, I think, is while there were no undocumented immigrants in the sample, because the sample was a sample of registered voters, there were a lot of people in the sample who knew undocumented immigrants, or who were the children of immigrants, or who had been immigrants at one time themselves, at least enough to for those perspectives to be included in the discussion. And so I think very often what happens when people do change opinions, and these are in confidential questionnaires, so the people never had to say to other people, I changed my mind, although some of them did when interviewed on camera. But it was confidential questionnaires like secret ballots. People change their opinion, I think, partly through some combination of the rational considerations and also empathy. All of a sudden, looking at the problem from the standpoint of other people who are affected by it. And that's a kind of part of moral reasoning, too, isn't it? Do unto others, et cetera, et cetera.
Talking to Jim Fishkin, director of the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford. We're talking about an event he hosted last month that got hundreds of people from all over America and all across the political spectrum together to discuss some hot button issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we need more of these civil conversations in our politics? Have you had productive talks with family or friends that you differ from politically? Has your viewpoint on an issue changed after encountering new facts or a new perspective? Do you think the way politics gets talked about by politicians and in the media makes it look more extreme and divided than it really is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Jim Fishkin stays with us. He's the author of Democracy When the People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. Last month, he brought together over 500 Americans to talk about hot-button issues and found an appetite for civil conversation and compromise. You can join in at 800-642-1234, wherever you are on the political spectrum. Does this sound like something you'd want to do? Have you found a way to have conversations with friends and family in your own life, even if you don't agree on important stuff? Have your views on a certain topic changed after finding new perspectives, new facts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My real question for your guest would be, I have found it amazing that when we do have discussions with people, whether they agree or disagree, you find that people are more centrist than what in the news media appears to be. And as such, I sometimes wonder why there aren't more centrist candidates in the electoral process. Why can't we have, say, a conservative financial president candidate who is also liberal socially? I find that just the dearth of centrist candidates to be lacking, and I'm wondering why that is.
Charlie, thanks for the call. And Jim, we've had people try to run as centrists, and it doesn't really seem to go very far lately.
Usually not, although President Macron in France ran as an enthusiastic centrist and surprised everybody by how well he did. But generally, the passion tends to be more on the extreme. I don't really want to like to use the term extreme because I don't want to stigmatize anybody, but on the people who are farther on the right or farther on the left, that's where the passion is. And we have the impression that people are generally more polarized because It's the people with a passion who speak up and who show up, and they give a somewhat distorted impression of public opinion. But the other thing is the people who speak for the people, who the talking heads on cable news and the rest, they will tend to have stronger opinions, and they give that impression. And I learned a long time ago that if you take a random sample of the public, they may have similar views to the rest, to the people who speak for them, but they're not going to be so entrenched. We discovered that in Northern Ireland when we did deliberative democracy projects with Protestants and Catholics. And the ordinary people were much more open to discussion than the people who lead the organizations that speak for the various sectarian groups there. And we found the same in other countries, too. And that's, in a way, what we found here. If in order to make your point, make your case, you need money, organization, and intensity. And sometimes those things go along with having views that are farther on the right or farther on the left.
Charlie, thanks for the call. We'll go to Mike now in Wauwatosa. Mike, hi.
Hi. So, Rob, I feel like we need to stop. It doesn't matter which political party you're from or what you identify with. People need to stop attacking each other over their views. There's a study that they discussed on the BBC, and they said when someone's attacked about their views, they actually become more entrenched in their views. What we need to do is, I feel, we need to stop attacking. We need to take the time, and if we expect to be heard, we also have to be willing to listen to the other person's point in a non-hostile, non-aggressive manner so that they feel that they're being heard and so that there's actually a dialogue as opposed to a monologue of the talking heads from each of the respective political corners.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And Jim, I know this is something you try to deal with in your sessions of deliberative democracy. How do you keep that kind of attack and getting the hackles up out of it as much as you can?
Well, Mike is exactly right, and he said it very eloquently. I think that, first of all, when we have experts or politicians, they're not allowed to give speeches. They're only allowed to respond to the questions from the small groups that the small groups develop. Secondly, in the small groups, we encourage civility and listening, and we make sure that the moderators make sure, without giving any hint of their own positions, the moderators make sure that that there's roughly equal participation and equal talking time. And we talk about the merits of the issue, and we try to discourage any finger-pointing. When we did in different cultures, sometimes it's different. I remember when we did the first national project that we did in Australia, which was on the question of whether Australia should get rid of the monarchy and become a republic. My Australian colleagues thought it was a matter of course that they made these big signs and put them in every room. And the sign said, "No personal insults," which I think was saying something about Australian culture, political culture. But it fit very much with Mike's comment. And we don't make those signs anymore, but we do have the moderators express some ground rules for the discussion. And people usually take to them very easily because they know how to be civil if that's the ground rule, and they all benefit from it because then they get listened to as well as having speaking time.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Jim Fishkin from Stanford University, talking about deliberative democracy. He recently, among many other projects, got hundreds of Americans across the political spectrum together at an event last month and found people wanted to be heard and wanted to listen to what other people had to say. And Jim, apart from the survey results, when you did this event last month, when you've done them elsewhere from Mongolia to Australia and elsewhere in the world, do you feel a hunger for this? Do people feel a need for a venue like this to have these kind of conversations?
Oh, yes. This is maybe even more now than ever because people feel that our democracies are coming apart. The divisions are producing deadlock. We're not getting anything done. We're going through life misunderstanding each other. So all of these projects generate increases in interpersonal trust and mutual respect. The percentage of people thinking that those on the other side They may disagree with them, but they have good reasons for what they're for their viewpoint. And I think this is the glue of civil society that's being unglued. I don't know what the right metaphor is when glue gets taken apart or gets but we're our glue, our social, the glue in our social fabric. Boy, I'm mixing metaphors.
But our
social fabric is coming apart, and I think that civil discussion with diverse others, not just is a prized quantity, because the so much of our politics is about mobilizing the already convinced, and just trying to appeal to your base and leaving the others out. And I think we need to and those people tend to be similar. And so the question is, how can you have civil dialogue across diversity and understand at least what the concerns are of others? And people get very surprised because one of the nice things about America in One Room, which you can just Google and find the results and the different all the stuff about it, was that we had the whole country in one room, rural, urban, young, old, all political persuasions, and we can go through every demographic in every category and show that how representative it was in, by comparing to the control group, how representative it was in all the political viewpoints. So everybody was there in microcosm. And so you could actually see public opinion taking shape, which is why I was grateful to the New York Times for publishing a supplement with the photos of all the people. I hope you don't mind my mentioning another media organization. But what they did was very unusual, because when I started years ago in Britain in 1994, when we did the first one of these, my British partner, a collaborator, said, when they gathered, he said, look at that sample. I wasn't quite sure why he wanted me to. He said, he grabbed my arm and said, look at them. I've selected thousands of random samples, but I've never seen one. No one has ever seen one. Because why? Because if you gathered them together, they might talk to each other. They might learn from each other.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Jim Fishkin, Janet Ampack, Chair of International Communication, Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. He talked to us about last month's America in One Room event that brought people together from all over the country to deliberate on some of our most polarizing issues. Coming up after the news, if you're listening right now, you may be commuting home from work. Up next, our guest says our commutes have shaped our cities from ancient times to today. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, how should power be balanced between Wisconsin's governor, attorney general, and legislators? That was one of the big questions before the state Supreme Court yesterday. We'll hear the arguments in a high-profile lawsuit. First, think about your daily commute to work. Maybe you drive 90 minutes one way, maybe you walk three blocks, and you're there. For a lot of us, about a half hour each way is the most we're going to want to put up with. Our next guest says that's been true throughout much of human history, and it's created cities as different as ancient Rome and modern-day Chicago. Jonathan English is a PhD candidate in urban planning at Columbia University. He recently wrote about this for City Lab in a piece titled "The Commuting Principle That Shaped Urban History." Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, tell us about this half-hour idea. You write that it's called the Marchetti constant.
Yeah, that's right. It's named after a scholar named Cesare Marchetti, although the idea has been percolating from a number of other people over time. But the basic idea is that people will travel about 30 minutes each way on average in their daily commute. Now, I say on average because, you know, some people go 2 hours, some people, yeah, will only walk three blocks. But it has held true remarkably well throughout history. Right now in the U.S., 26 minutes is the U.S. average. And this is important because as the average speeds, not the top speeds, the average speeds of transportation technologies change from foot to tram to car, that defines effectively how big cities can grow. And the size of cities relative to their populations determines things like how big our homes are, how expensive land is, and a lot of other things.
And this really changes over time, as you say, whether we're walking to work or taking some kind of train or driving. You have great visuals showing, you know, I think of ancient Rome as this huge sprawling metropolis. But then when you show it compared to, say, 1800s London or modern day Chicago or Atlanta, it was tiny because of the Marchetti constant, right?
Exactly. Because everybody in ancient Rome more or less was walking, or at least moving at a walking pace on a horse-drawn vehicle. Roughly speaking, a walking city is about 2 miles in diameter. And sure enough, you call, and that covers only a little over 3 square miles in area. So, you know, you talk about London, historic London is called the square mile. It's only 1 square mile. and it grew after. And then when the streetcar was invented, it could go quite a bit quicker. Let's say it could go, instead of 1 mile, it could go about 4 miles in that half hour. So that city could then cover 50 square miles. So from 3 to 50 square miles is a huge difference. And so that's why cities, you know, you started to see a lot more single family homes or townhouses instead of the really congested living that most people had in the walking city.
And it's pretty amazing to think about being crammed into that space. If you were a rich ancient Roman dude, you probably didn't live that far from the really poor ancient Roman dudes living in that really maybe very packed and maybe squalid housing unit.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the conditions that we have no idea how bad conditions were in cities as recently as 100, 150 years ago. You know, people wrote about piles of manure in the streets of New York City that were, 6 feet high, as tall as a person. From horses. So, and people lived, you know, 5, 6, 7 to a room, because land was, counterintuitively, people were living in these horrible conditions because land was so expensive, because everybody had to live within this very short distance from where they worked. Once people were able to live at a much greater distance, land became less valuable because there was effectively a lot more of it that could be used within a city. And as land becomes less valuable, people can use more of it. And when we had the car invented, so now we had this 40-mile diameter expressway city, roughly. So from the streetcar city of 50 square miles, you're now talking about a car city of 1,250 square miles, which, you know, in Europe or something, is a decent chunk of a country. And you know, as we see in the U.S., there are a lot of cities that take up, you know, a good chunk when you count all their suburbs of a whole state. And then you start to run into these problems of enormous consumption of land where we're having this huge effect on the landscape.
Talking to Jonathan English about a piece he wrote for City Lab called The Commuting Principle That Shaped Urban History. Generally, as humans, whether we're walking, driving, or whatever, we don't want to commute much more than a half an hour if we can avoid it. We asked you on the Ideas Network Facebook page about your commute. Laura said her commute is 12 minutes. Her husband's is 7. Laura says, I would not agree to more than a half an hour commute again. But Eric writes, up north, 90 minutes one way is common. Natasha says she spends a minimum of 2 hours in the car every day. Natasha says, in my daydreams, I don't own a car. So what happens there, Jonathan? We expand, we have this higher range because of the car, and we still build ourselves an environment where we drive way further, a lot of us, than we really want to.
Well, that's exactly right. And people are commuting or having longer and longer or more challenging commuting times, although these averages aren't changing as much. And we're also seeing the price of land skyrocket in especially the bigger city, because what we haven't seen is any new transportation technology. So for 100 years, from about 1850 or to about 1950, roughly speaking, we had a situation where there was an enormous amount of technological change, from the streetcar to to the car with the expressway that allowed people to cover a far greater distance than they could before. But really, since 1960, there haven't really been any new transportation technologies. We're still reliant on the same car and expressway that that we have been using for 50 years. And that means that cities are starting to get more crowded again as their populations grow, but they can't actually physically expand because of this very same constraint.
Now, we heard from Jackie on Facebook who says living close to work and not having to drive is the single biggest quality of life improvement she's ever made. Are we kind of intentionally changing our commutes? It seems like a lot of people find that walkable community more desirable now. Are we going to artificially change the rules now?
Well, you know, and I think the thing is, it's not necessarily as much of an artificial change as we think that it is, because in 1955 or 1960, 1965, when they were building the first interstate highways, you really could drive pretty fast. So, you know, you could drive 60 miles an hour, even at rush hour, but that didn't last more than a few years. And as congestion on these highways got worse and worse and worse, commutes out to suburban locations got longer and longer and longer. And that means that people are really rediscovering the idea of living in a city where instead of a 45-minute or longer drive, they're looking at a 20-minute walk or 25-minute walk to work. And that's a lot more appealing to them. So we're seeing this kind of urban revival across the United States, where people are maybe willing to move into older neighborhoods where they can walk to amenities instead of having to drive everywhere and deal with traffic congestion.
We've taken a whirlwind tour of the past and present of commuting. Jonathan, what are you watching for in the future?
Well, I think in a way, part of the problem that we face is that there are no obvious technological solutions on the horizon the way that, say, there were in the 1930s. In the 1930s, people invented this idea of the expressway, and we knew that this was something that was going to come, and it was just a matter of spending money on it. But now there are new technologies like automated cars, but that doesn't necessarily solve much of the congestion issue on our highways that we have. There are other options like telecommuting, for example, but there are certain human psychological limitations that seem to be limiting the adoption of that, even though the technology has been around for a few years now. So I think, honestly, the future, it's not as exciting to say, but might look a little bit like more of the same. You know, people are going to have to start in places where population is growing, living maybe on slightly smaller lots or living in more apartments, just because nobody wants to so many people want the big house with the big yard, but they're not willing to drive an hour and a half each day, or at least most people aren't, to make that happen anymore. So I think what we might see, at least for the foreseeable future, you know, barring flying cars or something like that, that would completely change things, which I don't think are happening anytime soon. I think that what we might end up seeing for the next while is more of the same that we've seen.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's Jonathan English, PhD candidate in urban planning at Columbia University. He was with us today to talk about how our willingness to commute has shaped our cities and rural communities and what it tells us about what those places could look like in the future. Coming up, we talk about arguments yesterday at the state Supreme Court over laws that came out of the legislature's lame duck session before Governor Evers took office. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report finds that Wisconsin's workforce is aging and there aren't enough young people to fill existing jobs or create new ones. Our guest says that could be a big drag on the state's economic future and offers some suggestions to help turn things around. Now, how much power should Wisconsin's legislative branch have? How about the governor or the attorney general? Those are some of the constitutional questions that came into play yesterday at the state Supreme Court. Justices heard oral arguments on one of many lawsuits related to lame duck laws passed prior to Governor Evers taking office. WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White joins us to break it all down. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
We've talked a lot about these challenges to these laws passed in lame duck session. Set this one apart from us. What is this particular lawsuit about?
So this is a lawsuit brought by the Service Employees International Union and some other individuals. Essentially, what they're arguing here is that some of the laws passed during the lame duck session violate the separation of powers guarantees within the state constitution for kind of separating powers between the branches of government in Wisconsin.
That means, like, you guys in the legislature, you get to do this stuff, the governor's office and maybe the attorney general, they get this stuff, and there's a line between those. That's the gist of the separation of powers concept, right?
Exactly. So the SEIU is arguing that some of these laws infringe improperly on the executive branch's power, kind of giving the legislature too much.
What were the particular infringements that were coming up in the arguments yesterday?
So there were a few things that really kind of took up a lot of the oxygen in the Supreme Court chamber. I think the biggest one was a provision that we've talked quite a lot about, and that's one that requires the attorney general to get approval from the legislature before he settles any lawsuits involving the state. So in the past, the attorney general could just kind of do that unilaterally. Under this lame duck law, he has to go to the state budget writing committee, sometimes called the Joint Finance Committee, and say, hey, this is a lawsuit I want to settle. These are the details. And this is a process that's really kind of caused some trouble in the state legislature in recent months, really, because the committee that's part of this law and the attorney general can't come to an agreement about how they discuss these cases and meet certain legal requirements for confidentiality.
So that's the attorney general and the lawsuit part. What else came up when it came to challenges to the way these lame duck laws affect the power of the executive branch?
So there were some other things. They talked about the governor, the governor's administration a little bit. They talked about a provision in here that places some more requirements on guidance documents that are issued by the Evers administration. Under the law, the legislature puts more more oversight and more public comment periods on some of these guidance documents. Those can be things like informational booklets that the Department of Transportation puts out for people on certain policies, things like that. Under this legal challenge, they're saying that the requirements put in place by the legislature are just too onerous for the Evers administration. Another thing that they talked about that kind of has to do with the governor and the governor's office is the ability of lawmakers to throw out administrative rules that are written by the Evers administration. So these administrative rules are kind of like, they have the force of law. They're kind of like laws, but they don't go through the legislative process. Under this lame duck bill, the legislature could throw those out without, you know, obviously without the Evers administration's consent because they created them. They like them, right? And this lawsuit is contending the legislature shouldn't be able to do that.
As you've described the lawsuit, the plaintiffs are arguing that all of these things unfairly, in effect, boost the power of the legislature at the expense of the executive branch. What did the lawyers for the legislature argue yesterday?
So this was a really interesting argument. So what they were essentially saying is that the attorney general's office, when we're talking about some of those powers that were taken away from the attorney general in particular, doesn't fall under the executive branch of government. And so therefore kind of infringing on his powers and the things that that he does isn't infringing on the executive branch because he's not a part of that branch. Lawyers for the legislature said that instead, the attorney general is part of a fourth branch of government called the administrative branch. And they made this argument because in the state constitution, the duties of the attorney general are prescribed as being written and given to him or given to that office by the legislature. There are very few things written into the constitution that are powers of the attorney general. Specifically in that document. So the lawyer for the legislature is saying, well, we can't be infringing on the executive branch through the attorney general because he's not in the executive branch. And that got some pushback from some of the justices.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about a state Supreme Court case. Arguments this week looking at limits to the powers of the governor and the attorney general. Well, the justices you just mentioned, they're the deciders here. What kind of things were we hearing from them yesterday?
So kind of in the vein of that argument about the attorney general and where his powers come from and sort of the overlap between the legislature and the AG, I think there was kind of an interesting line of questioning. And one of the justices really hit it on the head as he was going back and forth with the lawyer for Republicans. That was Justice Daniel Kelly, one of the court's conservatives.
The legislature can deprive the attorney general of the entirety of his authority and consign him to twiddling his thumbs all day long. However, that doesn't answer the question of where that power goes after it is withdrawn from the attorney general.
So that was really a big part of the argument about this element of the lame duck laws that takes away the attorney general's power to settle lawsuits. Justices that have partisan affiliations on both sides of the aisle, you heard Kelly there, conservative-backed justice, liberal-backed justices were kind of making this argument as well, that even if the legislature can take away duties from the attorney general because that power is given to them in the state constitution, it's not necessarily clear that they can assume those things that they take away without kind of blurring the lines of how the powers are separated in Wisconsin.
That's, as you said, with a voice from a generally perceived conservative justice there. What kind of things do we hear from some of the liberal justices?
So one of the court's liberal justices, Rebecca Dallet, had quite a bit to say during this line of questioning as well. She had a bit more of a straightforward argument in terms of the legislature, in her opinion, kind of overstepping its bounds and stepping on the responsibilities of the attorney general and what has traditionally been the purview of his office. So here's what she had to say about that.
You can grind to a complete halt this any kind of litigation that the attorney general is conducting, period. So the buck would stop with the legislature. That's not a seat at the table. That is, you are the one making that decision.
So this really was an argument at its core about, obviously, the balance of power within these branches of between these branches of government in Wisconsin, and sort of the push and pull between having a seat at the table and taking over the entire table, if you want to carry out that analogy. So it's certainly something that we heard from a variety of justices on the court. And as I said, you know, this really did take up a hefty amount of time of the 2 hours of arguments that we had yesterday.
And we talk about a conservative majority, liberal minority in the Supreme Court. But from some of the questions it asked, it doesn't sound like we can just assume that it's going to break down that way in their final decision.
That's right. So it seemed in this case, sometimes we try to read the tea leaves a little bit based on the kinds of questions that justices ask from the bench during oral arguments. And it seems kind of based on what they were asking that some conservative justices on the court might have some issues with some of these provisions. So obviously we won't know for sure until we get a ruling from the court. That could be, you know, several weeks away. There isn't a consistent kind of timetable for this sort of thing. But it does seem like we might be seeing a little bit more of a break between the traditional kind of party affiliations that we see on the court.
We'll watch for that result. And as I understand it, Laurel, there's one more case that hasn't been decided yet when it comes to these lame duck laws. This one in federal court, is that right?
That's right. So it's sitting in federal court in Chicago, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. They heard arguments on that case a couple years ago, actually, and we're still waiting for a ruling in that. So an unusual case that we're waiting that long, but we'll keep an eye on it.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, State Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. We talked to her today about yesterday's arguments at Wisconsin's State Supreme Court about lame duck laws and the balance of power in Wisconsin's government. get more on that and some of the other biggest issues facing state government this Thursday morning at 6 on The Morning Show. Kate Archer-Kent talks to leaders that day from the state Democratic and Republican parties. And by the way, join in the conversation about your commute time. That is live right now over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what your commute is and what you wish it was. If you've ever been interested in dinosaurs as a kid, a grown-up, watching Jurassic Park, whatever, there's a good chance you were fascinated by the Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's big. It's scary. You wouldn't want to run into one in the wild, but the T-Rex is fascinating. And you've probably thought at some point, I wish I could smell a T-Rex's breath. Wait, you've never thought that? Well, there's good news. You can, thanks to our neighbors in Illinois at the Field Museum in Chicago. The museum there has built a big multimedia exhibit about the T-Rex to build on the famous fossil of Sue the dinosaur. And as of this month, it passes the smell test. As reported in Atlas Obscura, researchers at the Field Museum worked with fragrance designers to reconstruct the smellscape of the Cretaceous era. A paleobotanist, for example, worked on the smells of the plant life of the time. That doesn't sound too bad. But T-Rex breath. According to the exhibit designer, from anatomical studies of Sue's teeth, we can say, well, you have the kind of anatomy that might suggest you have some nasty raw meat decaying in your mouth. Whitfield, the designer, says, what did that smell like? The answer is bad. Apparently, they had one recreation that they thought was pretty true to life, would have smelled like the T-Rex, but it was really too much to subject museum goers to, so they dialed it back a little. And I wonder about the fragrance designers, you know, who are used to maybe designing perfumes and colognes, and then they get an order for T-Rex breath. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.